Over the last few weeks, we've been hearing stories from all across the world, and today we wanted to have a little bit more of a local flavor as we partner with God and Mission Everywhere. Come, guys. Yep. And so I thought it would be really cool to get my friend Paul and my other friend Anna, who is also his wife, to come back again. You might remember Paul. He preached in a very Scottish accent a few weeks back. And it's not just because I wanted to put them on the payroll here, but rather because they're engaged in some interesting work. And so I thought it would be cool to sit down and have a conversation with them this morning. And you can all sit in on that and be a part of it. So we're going to settle down on the couches. You're going to settle back in your seats. And we're going to have a bit of a chat together about local mission in their context. Last year we did all of these as interviews, and by the end I kind of got into the swing of it, but this is my interview mojo. I just need to...
Great. It could be a train wreck.
Yeah, well, we'll build it up. So tell us all a little bit just about yourselves. Who are you? What do you do?
Sweet. So as I mentioned, I know it's surprising because I've got a heavily Kiwi-ized accent now, but I'm obviously, as I mentioned, originally from Scotland. Came to faith when I was 18, and that was 2002, and then moved out to New Zealand with my parents and my brother not long after that. Kind of brief story of me, I spent most of my last 16 years in Auckland up until recently. Went to Bible college very early on, wanted to learn about my faith and so on. You guys clicked into my accent? Good. And went to Bible college, did that for a few years. Then joined a kind of like a missional community in South Auckland, Mangere, for a few years. Ran away from that, took a job as a pastor, where I met Tim and Liz, Roscoe Baptist.
Represent.
Yep. Was there for quite a while. And while I was pastoring there, I was involved in, on the side, helping start with a group of about, 18 young adults, a kind of missional community. So did that for a while, stopped being a pastor after a while. We joined up with a crew called Urban Vision, which you'll hear about, Dirty Anglicans. They're part of that movement now, and kind of did some time there. Got ordained, both got the collar in our spare time. And then, what did we do? We did a good season there. Then we've just recently moved to Whanganui in January. And what do I do there? I work part-time in a cafe, mainly clean dishes to pay the bills, in Castlecliff, called the Citadel, if you ever come in for a coffee. So do that. We spend a lot of time with neighbours, getting to know people, do a lot of meals, and we've just kind of church planted on the side in our spare time. That's me. Oh, I have a son as well. Sorry, go on.
We have a son. Yeah, he's up the back. His name's Ishmael. I'm Anna. I'm originally from Sri Lanka. I grew up, though, mainly in Mount Roscoe in Auckland, and that I grew up with Tim and Liz. And I knew Jesus from a really young age, so I suppose my faith journey has just been increasingly saying yes to Jesus' invitations to me. I had a passion for mission and justice at a young age, and so I trained as a lawyer originally and went overseas with an organisation called International Justice Mission, helping to rescue people out of modern-day slavery. And I came back from my time away intending to sort of upskill and go back out there. And I came back, and Paul was the new pastor at Mount Roscoe. And
this gave me some benefits.
And he was sort of challenging the whole church, but particularly the group of young adults, to really consider what local mission looked like. And I suppose as a church, we'd really thought about what it looked like to offer services and programs to our local community, but not to relationally engage and put skin in the game. And so there was this challenge to relocate to our local neighbourhood and to really build relationship there. And it was a challenge that I was up for. So I did that and joined this community. And increasingly, my life became very local. I ended up leaving my job as a lawyer and starting working as a community development worker. And somewhere in there we got together. And then since then, life's followed a very similar trajectory to Paul, with the difference that now I work part-time in Whanganui for the Anglican Diocese and the New Zealand Church Missionary Society. And my job is called Intercultural Communities Enabler, which is quite a mouthful. But essentially what it is helping the church to wrestle with what does it look like to embrace the diversity in a way that's reciprocal with the difference and diversity that we find in our local communities, and also to strengthen our ethnic and language-specific congregations.
Yeah. You can hold on to that. Does anyone ever call that role ICE? Like, either ICE woman?
No, because that's the American Detention Organization.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
That bombed.
And
him.
We're off to a good start.
Mate. Wow.
So you mentioned a little bit about Urban Vision before. Tell us a little bit more about Urban Vision. What is it? What do you guys do?
You can talk a bit of what it actually is, just in terms of our journey into that, just to give a bit of context. So we, in Mount Roskill, we were kind of, we took this group of about 18 keen young adults, ended up being into the neighbourhood across the road from the church. It's kind of like a kind of classic deficit-based communities in terms of statistics, you know. Lower socioeconomic, high migrant refugee community. Kind of had the reputation for its kind of gang culture, all that kind of carry on. And we kind of moved in across the road and started getting involved. And we kind of just wanted to be good neighbours was the intention, I suppose. Kind of just be a good kind of just neighbourly presence. And it was beautiful, but it was really hard yards. And we learned a lot, not just about others, but definitely about ourselves. Some pretty hard lessons. And I think during that journey, we connected with, obviously, Urban Vision. And that's a bunch of people that have been doing similar kind of community-based stuff in Wellington for the last 20 years and who still love Jesus. And so we were kind of realizing that we kind of we needed to be part of something bigger than ourselves, and with people that kind of got us, and we hooked in with them basically. We kind of wanted some wisdom, some input, but also be part of something where we kind of felt like we kind of belonged and kind of learn how to be sustainable for the long haul in that kind of culture. So we joined our vision from that. Yeah.
Yeah, so Urban Vision started off as just a group of mates who moved into a local neighbourhood, and over the 25 years it really grew, and they recognised as well that they didn't want to be this sort of random group off to the side. They wanted accountability to the church as well, and so they became a missional order of the Anglican Church in New Zealand. And so what that looks like in practice on the ground is it's small households that have located into neighbourhoods that are on the margins, where the struggle really is real. And within that, we sort of commit to different things that sustain that life together. And so at the moment, Urban Vision's in Wellington, Shannon, Whanganui and Auckland. And so the things that we sort of say that we're about, and we actually covenant to one another and to God about, the first thing is that we say we have a deep Jesus centre, and that means that our life comes from our relationship with Jesus first and foremost. And so there's an encouragement then to nurture our individual faith, but also a commitment within our common life to nurturing our relationship with God. So, for example, in our team, that looks like Monday to Friday, our team gathers for prayer every morning at 7:15 to pray for our neighbourhood and for one another's needs. The second thing we say that we're about is deep belonging to one another. And so again, that's about finding a place of deep belonging within our team so that we're really vulnerable and open to growing in our relationship with God and with one another and within our neighbourhoods. And so that looks like shared meals with one another, keeping one another accountable, really journeying through the ups and downs of life together. And the third thing that we covenant to is giving our best for the least. And that's probably the biggest marker, or I guess, that separates what we're doing from other expressions of faith. And so in that sense, what we're talking about is that relocation to the margins of society and choosing to live a life where I guess we work to live. So we talk about being bivocational, and that means that we see our paid work and our work in our neighbourhoods equally as vocations. And so we only work enough, well, most of us only work enough that we're able to live simply so that we have energy and time left over for our neighbours so that we can give our best in that space.
So how that looks a little bit, or? Okay, so how, is this interesting, by the way? Are you sure?
Don't give them the opportunity to say no.
No, just say no and just go off and get on with the rest of it. So how that looks in terms of, so I'll use Mount Roskill as a context because I can talk about it now, I suppose, so our team obviously had quite a big group all working part-time or studying, but it was lots of meals with neighbours, like heaps of meals with neighbours. My dinner table is munted as a result, but lots of meals, lots of community celebrations. So any chance we got to celebrate a birthday, it was an opportunity to gather people together, particularly a neighbour's birthday, maybe neighbours that maybe wouldn't have lots of people wanting to celebrate with them, or just life goes on and you kind of forget. So lots of that kind of stuff. Lots of sports teams involvement with local kids, local teenagers particularly. And then there's kind of that undercover mentoring of like some of the kids from overseas and stuff that are struggling to kind of adapt to New Zealand culture. Open home stuff, so obviously done a bit of fostering, but our teams have done things where kids that maybe at that age where they can live independently but aren't doing too good at home come live in some of the homes, short or long term, through to reading club involvements, through to, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anything else? Well, there's heaps.
In each context looks really different. So, for example, we have an inner-city Wellington team that offers emergency accommodation to young men who would otherwise be on the street. And we have a team in Nai Nai who their paid role is their chaplains in Rimutaka Prison. But outside of their paid work, they have young men come and stay with them that have made a decision for Jesus while they've been in prison and really want to change their life when they come out. Part of their team does fostering, they run the local parish church, they run a veggie co-op, and they're supporting a new social enterprise for young women coming out of Arohata Women's Prison to give them work experience and employment. So, yeah, really diverse, depending on where people are at in terms of life stage. You know, when you're young and a student, you have a different kind of capacity and energy to when your family with children, or to when you maybe your children have left home. So yeah, really diverse.
It probably it sounds full on. How has God challenged and changed you guys through this time that you've set aside for engaging in this way?
So I think one brief one, and I'll talk to one other one, but one brief one is just simply walking with people that are particularly broken. I suppose early on, you just get awakened to the reality of how complex people's lives are, you know? Like, it's kind of, maybe younger years, or maybe, I don't know, but younger years certainly for myself, it's all black and white, everything's very black and white, but life is so grey, and it's so messy, and it's so complex, and you get overwhelmed by just the reality of that. That was a big challenge, but also realising the amount of commonalities that we share with our neighbours who are very different. Realising quite quickly on, we share the same fragilities, the same frailties, the same vulnerabilities, and the same hopes, similar hopes for the world and for each other. So there's that kind of beauty in that as well. So that's one thing. Does that make sense? Yeah. Second thing, I'll probably share a story, but second thing would be just realising that when you throw yourself into a context or with people where it's particularly messy and hard, there's more opportunity for God's beauty and the beauty of life to kind of flourish, and you see it more visibly because it's so, the contrast is so big. So I've got time for a story.
Yeah, cool. Story time.
So as an story time. Here we go. So an example of that is, so in Roskill, for example, there was these two women, I'll change their names to Fiona and Joe. And Fiona and Joe, we met them while we were still living on the street with one other guy, living on the streets, using the glue bags. But one we noticed wasn't using the glue bag, and that was Joe. And she was pregnant, and she decided, she'd lost her kids to SIFs a couple of times beforehand, but she decided she wanted to make a go of this, so she was staying clean. she was staying sober. And we just got to know them at that point. And long story short, we offered, look, do you guys... Well, particularly you, do you want to move in with us, or do you guys want to move into our collection of homes and have a better context to make good choices? So they move in, and so Joe basically stayed with us for just over a couple of years. Ended up keeping Babs, did really well, thrived. You know, there was heaps of ups and downs, some pretty heavy ups and downs. Good, but it was a really positive time for her. Fiona, she was quite a complex young woman, late teens, I think, when we first met her. She, as well as being a heavy glue user, she also had disabilities. She hardly could hardly see. You know, she'd hold her phone here, you know, reading texts from here. But also, she had this condition where she shook. There's a lot of trauma in her life, so I don't know if it was related to that, but she would shake like this all the time. So you can imagine living with someone like that, trying to help feed somebody. You know, you've got their fork. could be quite dangerous. The toilet can be a mess. So it was quite, for her, I think just there was a lot of shame for her in her own life, but also just life was hard. So for her, her journey, she would be in and out over those 2-3 years of living with some of her houses out. But then she would kind of gap it. And we wouldn't hear from her for a while. Then she would show up again, and what can I try and get herself clean or whatever, and come and live again and share a room or whatever. But it was a real struggle. Anyway, so moving on, got to this point about 2.5 years in, and Fiona had kind of gone off the scene again, I suppose, and hadn't heard from her for a while. And she popped up because she got in trouble with the law. And she was up in court for some stuff, pretty minor stuff. But the big issue was that her body was wasting away. She just hadn't been looking after it. So it was kind of life and death stuff, basically. She was told, you need to sort stuff out or you're going to die, was basically what the doctor was telling her. And also the court had said, we don't need to go to prison, but the only way for you to go to prison, you have to go to a residential facility to get clean and to work on some of your issues. So it meant that she can't come and stay in our home, which is probably better for her at that point, to be honest. But the problem was no rehab in Auckland would take her because, one, she had an addiction and there was not enough spaces, but also they weren't set up for people with disabilities, would you believe? So she had nowhere to go. And we just felt powerless, and what are you supposed to do except pray? And then, bizarrely, this woman who ran an old folks' home for kind of for old people on the benefit who don't have maybe the support systems in place to go to a nice old folks' home. So it's a pretty rugged old folks home, but it's lovely. There's a good spirit about the place. Offered to take our 21-year-old friend to do rehab in the old folks home, sharing a room with this lady who was a mental health consumer in her 60s. Long story short, that's another story for another time. Maybe next time I come and speak next year. But that was, she basically, over that 6 months, got clean for the first time in her life. Outrageous, outrageous story. But anyway, that's a different story. But she got clean, and so Anna, am I talking too much, too fast? No, there we go. Give me the kick if I am, I. Cool. Anna had been kind of journeying quite heavily with her through that whole time, so you would go in a couple of times a week, have a bit of a feed with her while she's getting herself together and whatever else. And you used to do this thing, Anna used to do this thing called good reports. It was basically, you know, let's share what we're thankful to God for from this week. And that was just one of the traditions they did. So that was kind of going on. Keep that in mind. And as our kind of Fiona's confidence was building, Anna was saying, look, do you want to come and have a meal with our crew again? Do you want to come and see your old friends and see the Babs? Because she hadn't really seen the Babs much. Do you want to come and share a meal? And she eventually said, yeah, I want to come back and have a meal and celebrate. So the first time she came back for a meal, it was a pretty big deal. You know, there's a couple of our households were together just having a big feed. And you just had Fiona and Joe reconnecting. It was beautiful. You know, Fiona, she's shaking, but she's holding the baby. And it's just a really lovely time of reconnection. And got to the end of the night and we had to kind of take Fiona back to the old folks' home or the place. And as we were going our way home with Fiona, Joe, myself, Anna and the baby, Anna goes, "Oh, we haven't done our good reports. You know, what are we thankful to God for?" And so we explained what it was to Joe. And so we thought, "Oh, let's do it." So we're in our little crappy Toyota Camry. I hated that car, man. 1991, piece of crap. Anyway, I was in this car and we're taking her back to the place and I share something of what I'm thankful to God for that week. And Anna shares something of what she's thankful to God for that week. And then Fiona, our friend, she shares, you know, she shares, "Look, I just want to say I'm really thankful that I'm back with my sis, you know, back with my sis, and I'm getting to see her being a mum and she's got her baby, and I'm just real thankful that we've got to have this time together and get to see my sis with our bubs." And then Joe, now Joe's like staunch. She doesn't do deep and meaningful, right? She does, it's not her gig. She keeps it light and keeps it quiet. But she's pretty staunch, but she goes, "Oh, I don't want to share something." And we're like, "Oh, here we go." Everyone's ears pricks up. The car, and she goes, "I just want to say, you know, I'm real thankful that, you know, I've known that I'm back with my sis, our street sister, back with my sis. I'm thankful that, you know, we've known each other since we're 14 on the street. And it's about 7 or 8 years now. We've known each other for that length of time, and this is the first time we've seen each other both sober, and it's like we're seeing each other for the first time."
Wow.
And you know, you talk about sacred moments or sacred ground moments. It felt like that car was a sacred car. There was just something special about that moment. Well, it was something special about that moment where, you know, we'd done hard yards for a few years with that guys, but that moment where you just knew this is a kingdom of God moment. And there's a kind of transformational moment happening right now, and it's climax right now. It made all the battle worth it. Yeah, so beauty in the mess.
Yeah, and I guess parallel to that, I mean, those few years, there was so much grief and loss and just moments of real bleakness. And I think one of the other things that we've really learnt over the last, I guess, 10 or so years, has been just to see those moments of hope even in the midst of despair. And I think something that really brought that home for me was last year, a friend of ours, I'll call him David, he passed away. And David was someone we met really early in our time in Mount Roskill. At that time, he was living on the street, and as we got to know a little bit of his story, it was he just suffered the sort of every kind of trauma you can imagine growing up in an abusive home and in the state care system. And he went to prison when he was 17, and that just kind of cemented the trajectory of his life. He never had a stable home after that, lived most of his life on the street. And when we first met him, it was his partner who had chosen to go sober so that she could keep her baby, and that gave him motivation to change. And so he spent the next couple of years living between our homes and had a really great patch, actually, where they moved out independently and lived with three of their children for a few years. But he made some bad choices, and so over the last couple of years he's spent most of his time in prison or back on the street again, and suffered from really, really poor health. And so last year we got a call from his ex-partner to say he died, probably of an overdose, and that was just devastating. It was such a pointless death. And, you know, he leaves behind these five young children. It was awful. And there's no family. There's nowhere for his body to go home to. He's a young Māori man. No connection to a marae. And so, I guess, in the midst of that, we were like, what can we offer in this situation? And at least in my culture, it's normal to bring the body home. And so we thought, well, that's the best that we can offer, is to say, look, we'll host his tangi at our house. And so The body came home and the visitors start to arrive and we realise there's no men. There's literally only women and children because all the men are dead or in prison. Like, it is just, yeah, just horrific to see how awful things were. And it would have been so easy to be caught up in just that grief and that loss and that pain of that situation. And I'm just, I guess, really thankful because God showed up in just the most amazing ways that we got to see little glimmers of hope in the midst of all that darkness. And so one of them was that our friend David, he was one of about 20 siblings. Many of them had never met before. And so his tangi was the first time that some of his brothers and sisters actually got to meet one another and connect, and for the younger siblings to learn a little bit about their whakapapa, and it was a really special time. He had a young sister who was a few months pregnant and living on the street in Auckland, and her big sister, who hadn't seen her since she was about 2 years old, she's like, Anna, we're getting in the car, we're going to go find her. I was like, okay. And so we go to down Queen Street in Auckland, and she's like, got some other friends helping, and she's like, oh, look, there she is. And they literally like just get out of the car and kind of kidnap her and bring her home. And this young woman, I mean, she's been on the streets most of her life. She unfortunately was really wasted at the time and didn't have a lot of prospects or hope in her life. And her big sister brought her home, and she connected with her family, ended up actually going home with her big sister and trying to get her life sorted, which was really, really amazing, yeah. And then we also watched this other young woman. She sort of led the Streeties Collective in Auckland, and she was still sleeping rough and living on, sorry, other friends' floors at the time. And she just stepped up, eh? Like, she learnt to karanga so that she could welcome all the visitors to our home and welcome the body home. She knew that we were meant to have karakia every night, so she doesn't have a background. She's like scouring our bookshelves, finding random like Walter Brueggemann poems and psalms, and leading prayer services. She's actually from a rival gang. And so the love that she has for our friend David, and I mean all his family were from the same gang. So for her to stay at our home was a big deal in itself, actually. And then, you know, for her to love and Afi that family in their moment of grief was a really, really special time. So it was just all these moments where you really saw the kingdom of God breaking through, and you could see hope, even though it was so tragic, and it didn't take away how awful and horrific the situation was. But it offered something and something different for the future.
How do you feel like God's kind of changed you guys through all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think one of the big things, which I think we knew in our heads but is really cemented into our hearts, is that what we offer people is Jesus, it's not us. And so time and time again in those situations, we've needed to see God's transformation breakthrough, and that's not something we can give. There's sort of a like a youth worker mantra, I guess, that's care not cure. But actually what we need is the cure, but it can't come from us, right? Like, Jesus is the healer, and we really need him to break through into our friends' lives. And so more and more, I think that's what we long for and look for and try and point people towards as we go.
My one's pretty simple. I think it's probably a big lesson or a big change in myself. Anyway, it's just a lot more gracious toward people. You know, you realise how frail, how messy the whole thing is, and just have a lot more grace to extend. And also to ourselves, or myself as well, probably. But yeah.
And while you're doing all this stuff at the moment, you're also kind of, as you alluded to, you're sort of doing church as well in your spare time. Why? And what does that look like?
So we're doing or being church. Obviously, we're both ordained and we're involved in our parish, or our local context. So together, you know, we're part of Urban Vision, but we're like, Urban Vision is not church. It's an expression of a church. It's for a particular brand of people that want to do a particular way of doing things. So not everyone can kind of participate in that to a certain degree, but everyone has to participate and is blocked as part of church. So it's been important for us to just be part of a wider church family, and obviously we've recently just kind of church planted a faith space for people that maybe don't quite fit the regular kind of format of church as is. But we just want to create a space that's welcoming for everyone, where everyone can feel they belong and contribute. Yeah. Want to speak to that a bit more? Was that, can I? Yeah, I don't, no. Is that, can I answer your question?
Yeah. Yep. So do you guys have a service this afternoon?
We do, 5 o'clock, yep.
Are you preaching?
Yeah, we do a kind of discussion-based thing.
Oh,
yep.
Cool.
Yeah, there we go, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, don't make me think of that. I've not planned it properly. Anyway, go on.
No. So just last question. It's kind of a big one. You guys have spent a lot of time in different spaces, kind of you know this environment, you know this context, you know the kind of outside the monastic community, the parachurch kind of context as well. You know New Zealand. What do you think are the biggest challenges that we face as the church in New Zealand today? What might faithfulness to God look like in our context now?
I think we've probably not accepted that we're moving to the margins. We've probably been in denial for quite a long time as a church, thinking that we're at the centre. But a church that is at the centre is it can become complacent really easily, because you experience, you know, all the benefits of being there, and ultimately, in some senses, become beholden to that dominant culture. And so I actually think one of our biggest challenges is to see moving to the margins as a gift for the church, because, you know, the church, I mean, historically, in times of persecution, the church has really grown, and I don't think that's what we're experiencing. Like, we're not experiencing persecution, but it's this opportunity for us to really to change, to innovate, to take risks and think about, well, what does the church have to say to the world? And when you're in the centre, it's very hard to do that. But when you're on the margins, you have that prophetic voice again. And I think that's a real opportunity for us in New Zealand and the church in the West as a whole to really take up that mantle. I think that's our challenge, is to see that being on the margins is a gift that we're being offered, and to actually take it.
Mine's kind of connected to that, not as deep, because I'm just not as deep as her, but I think it's kind of related. I think the probably the biggest challenge in my, especially in light of, like, if we were to accept that as a church we're on the margins now, the biggest challenge, or a big challenge, is I think as a church we are so scared of failure, it cripples us. You know, we're so risk averse. And I think that comes from, we've probably bought into society's obsession with being successful. You know, we're so obsessed with trying to be successful rather than fruitful. You know what I mean? That subtle shift. And because of that obsession with being successful and being perceived to be successful, we just don't take risks. We're scared of failure because it's seen as a thing of shame for us. So, for example, you know, I was thinking about it on the way here going, as an example, how often have I heard of, and not very often at all, but that God would call, say, a home group of adults and say, I want you to sell your homes, and I want you to buy homes in the rugged part of town and give your best for that particular neighbourhood. Now, either, I never, ever, hardly ever hear of that. It's either God's not interested in that kind of thinking, or maybe we're not listening. And I wonder if we're not listening because the thought of doing something like that could be perceived as like failing. You know, we're not hitting the success. No, we're not on the upward trajectory. But we're just, there's this fear of risk, of failure. We've seen it with young adults. You know, young adults want to do crazy, awesome things with their lives. But often parents, for example, just so frightened that they're giving up on careers and stuff, kind of pushing back, Christian parents pushing back at their Christian sons or daughters wanting to do stuff for the kingdom of God, that that they kind of stop the trajectory of something that could be fruitful. So, for example, I've got this friend who's overseas doing amazing missionary stuff. This is a missionary story, I suppose. And this young woman from the South Island wanted to join and has joined and doing amazing things with that in a Muslim majority country. We had to give our life to that. And her parents, I'm sure well-meaning Christian parents, offered to pay her not to go. But and that's an extreme story, but it's actually not that uncommon. You know, there's this thing of just the fear of failure of us or those close to us not doing well cripples us from taking risks. You know what I mean? And I think that even just like that fear of failure means that we don't see a lot of church planting in different communities that have, where there's creativity or innovation happening because we're scared it might not work out. I think that's tragic. Or social enterprise businesses, people having all these great ideas, but saying, oh, I don't want to do it because I might lose money or I might lose face or whatever else. And it's just like, failure is part of our journey. Failure is part of the disciples' journey. The difference between failure in the kingdom of God and otherwise is that with God, failure is never final. It's often the biggest opportunity to learn and develop and for the greatest gifts to come out of those failures. But I think our challenge is to get over that fear of failure and think through what it looks to be fruitful.